Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, December 2021 edition. The Last of the Old-Time Prospectors by John Fillmore. Shorty Harris's bonanzas and burros were almost as legendary as he was. He may be the last person to have been buried on public property after it had become a national park or national monument. 2 years after his death in 1934, a special memorial service was conducted at his grave with some 200 people attending. At the ceremony, a bronze plaque was placed with the words, which said in part, "Bury me beside Jim Dayton in the valley we loved." Above me write, "Here lies Shorty Harris, a single blanket jackass prospector." Frank Harris was born, by his own account, on July 21st, 1857, in Rhode Island, to an Irish father and Scottish mother, both of whom died when he was about 7 years old. Adopted by an aunt, he began working at 11 years old at a calico mill. At 14, he ran away from his aunt's home and worked a variety of jobs in the surrounding states until at last he got an itch to travel west. In 1878, he had found his way to Leadville, Colorado, which was at the peak of gold and silver mining in the state. He worked for a time as a hard rock miner in shafts and tunnels before he and two friends decided to try their hand at prospecting. They saved enough money to outfit themselves with the typical miner's necessities, including burros. Several weeks after leaving Leadville, they made their first strike, staking a claim on a site with a good showing of silver ore, which they subsequently sold for $7,500. This, Harris claimed, was the first real money he ever got. He traveled to Denver to put on a party that made them all sit up and take notice. But in 6 weeks, he was stone broke. That was all Harris needed to get hooked on prospecting, and he seemed to have been fortunate in locating good claims as he drifted from Colorado to Wallace, Idaho. From there to several mining districts in Montana, the mid-1880s found him in Frisco, Utah, and shortly after that, Tombstone, Arizona. From there, he journeyed to Virginia City, Nevada, and Bodie, California. But the area where he spent the most time was in the Eastern Californian desert, Death Valley and vicinity. In the Panamint Ridge, he and a partner found ore so rich that, as miners say, it has the eagle stamped right on it. Harris's use of burros was summed up in an interview he gave a few years before his death. "All my traveling in this country was done on the hurricane deck of a jackass, and believe me, that's the way all the big strikes have been made. A jack can go almost anywhere that a mountain sheep can, and carry all that and then that a man needs for several weeks. You've heard it said that gold is where you find it. I'll tell you that it's usually found in places that are hard to get to, and a burro can get there when a horse or a mule would be stalled for good." His bullfrog bonanza. It was his burros that led Harris to his most famous mining discovery in 1904, the bullfrog claim. He and partner Ed Cross made camp in the Amargosa Desert of southwestern Nevada. In the morning, Harris went out to round up his burros and found them feeding on the side of a mountain near the camp. A few hundred feet away, he spied a ledge with some copper stains on it. After breaking a piece off with his pick, he was astonished to see chunks of gold so big that it seemed to me the whole mountain was made of gold. It was the greenish color of the rock that led Harris to name it the Bullfrog Mine. Within a few weeks, thousands of people swarmed to the area of the new strike, many from nearby Goldfield. New towns were staked out: Bonanza, Bullfrog, Amargosa City, and Rolite. Eventually, Bullfrog and Rolite absorbed the others, and Rolite became the commercial center of the district, at one point having stations for three different railroad lines. The largest and most successful mine in the district was the Montgomery Shoeshone, which eventually came to be owned by Charles Schwab. But if it seemed Shorty Harris had finally found the claim that would make him his first $1 million, a moment of weakness had cost him that opportunity. In his own words, "One night, when I was pretty well lit up, a man named Brian took me to his room and put me to bed. The next morning when I woke up, I had a bad headache and wanted more liquor. Brian had left several bottles of whiskey on a chair beside the bed and locked the door. I helped myself and went back to sleep. That was the start of the longest jag I ever went on. It lasted 6 days. When I came to, Brian showed me a bill of sale for the bullfrog, and the price was only $25,000. I got plenty sore, but it didn't do any good. There was my signature on the paper, and beside it, the signatures of 7 witnesses and the notary's seal. I felt a lot worse when I found out that Ed had been paid $125,000 for his half and had lit right out for Lone Pine, where he got married." Whether this particular version of the circumstances surrounding the sale of the Bullfrog Mine is accurate is difficult to ascertain, since Harris never told the same story about it twice. To be sure, the Bullfrog excitement, like many other strikes, was far less profitable for the gold extracted than it was for the sale of the stocks and mining properties. Less than a decade after Harris and Cross located the Bullfrog claim, Rowlite and Bullfrog had become ghost towns. None of this stopped Harris from continuing his quest for the motherlode. He crossed Death Valley and soon located claims near Skiddo, and a site which became his namesake, Harrisburg. The Harrisburg mine had the potential to make him a rich man. He accepted a combination of cash and stock, but at that time, company directors could vote to levy an assessment on stock, requiring the holder to pay up or lose his holdings. Such was the case with Harris, who let his stock go instead of paying the assessment. The final years. Harris spent his remaining years just west of Death Valley in the desert ghost town of Ballarat, California. He lived in the abandoned schoolhouse and continued to prospect the surrounding hills, always optimistic about finding the next big strike. In 1933, a portion of the adobe schoolhouse collapsed, trapping Harris and causing him serious injury. He was discovered by friends, few of whom held out any hope of his survival. But survive he did, and after a long recovery, he was determined to return to the Panamint Mountains to prospect. He also did some work on the local roads for the county, which provided him some money for food. He and a few remaining residents of Ballarat regaled each other with stories of the old days. His best friend, Jimmy Dayton, had died in July of 1898. Dayton, a former prospector and swamper for the famed 20 Mule Team Borax Wagons, had been a caretaker at the Furnace Creek Ranch. The circumstances of his death were recounted several years later in one of Rowlite's newspapers, The Bullfrog Miner. Dayton had started from Furnace Creek for Daggett with an empty wagon to get supplies for the farm. He was drawn by 4 horses and had 2 horses tied to the wagon in the rear. He had a cat in a box, which he was taking to a friend at Daggett, and a dog followed along. He had been due in Daggett for 2 weeks, and not arriving, Frank Tilden and a Mexican by the name of Dolph started out in search. It was midsummer, and they traveled by night. Within a mile and a half of the Old Eagle Borax Works, they came upon the wagon of Dayton, which was in the road about 8 miles this side of Bennett's Hole. Around the wagon were 6 dead horses in harness. Dayton's body lay under a mesquite bush near the roadside, and his dog sat by it as the only silent mourner. The cat in the box was also dead. They had been there 22 days. A survey of the place told the story. Dayton had become deranged from the heat. He had left his wagon and sought shade under the mesquite. He had died. The lead horse had drawn his companion around to the wagon to secure water or feed and became entangled with the standard projecting above the wagon body. They had stood there in a circle until they all perished. The dog had found his way to a pool of slimy water a mile and a half distant and sustained himself. He kept the vultures and coyotes away from the body of his master for 22 days. Once, when Shorty was visited by writer and friend William Carruthers, the two men were driving through Death Valley and stopped at Dayton's grave. Shorty walked into the brush and gathered up a handful of desert wildflowers to place on the grave. Then, turning to Carruthers, he said, "When I die, bury me beside old Jim. Above me write, 'Here lies Shorty Harris, a single blanket jackass prospector.'" Shorty died in his sleep on November 10th, 1934. He was 78 years old. The short man was laid to rest next to Jimmy Dayton with one of the largest crowds ever gathered in Death Valley in attendance. A miner, Wallace Campbell, wrote a poem for him. It was 15 months after the death of Harris that the National Park Service conducted the memorial service and erected the monument which still stands today. It carries the bronze plaque which bears Shorty's epitaph, just as he had requested. A few months before Shorty died, while recovering from his accident, William Carruthers had asked him if he would choose prospecting again if he had his life to live over. "I wouldn't change places with the President of the United States. My only regret is that I didn't start sooner. When I go out, every time my foot touches the ground, I think, before the sun goes down, I'll be worth $10 million. Carruthers reminded him that he never got his $10 million. Giving Carruthers an incredulous look, Shorty replied, "Who in the hell wants $10 million? It's the game, man, the game." True West, December 2021. Night of the Rockies by Jerry Insler. Jim Bridger, once a teenaged mountain man, became one of the most dependable and renowned trailblazer of the vast lands of the American West. For more than a century, some historians have marked a distinct period of exploration dating from the expedition of Lewis and Clark in 1804 to 06 to the establishment of Fort Bridger on the Oregon Trail in 1843. Jim Bridger played a significant role in that period, and in the next as well. Bridger was a mountain man, the proudest of all the titles worn by the Americans who lived their lives out beyond the settlements, wrote Bernard DeVoto in The Year of Decision, 1846. And he was one of the best of mountain men, with courage and skill, knowledge and determination. He lived a life wild and free, and he embodied an American ideal, as Daniel Boone had a generation earlier. Bridger had not set out to be a hero. What had mattered to him, as it happened, mattered to the nation. Exploring the Rockies, discovering the Great Salt Lake, opening the routes to Oregon and California, and forging alliances with the Shoshones, Salish, Nez Perce, and Crows. A company man. Under Andrew Henry and William Ashley's direction, Bridger and his fellow trappers had been active participants in revolutionizing the fur trade. With free trappers, overland routes, and the annual rendezvous, there was no need for established forts. The men were free to hunt the mountains year-round, and by living in lodges each winter, they were able to set traps each fall and spring, the prime trapping seasons. They could be resupplied each summer and only paid when they brought in pelts. The first Rocky Mountain rendezvous in July 1825 marked the beginning of a new way to supply American trappers and collect their hauls. Bridger and the others would remain full-time hunters, spending the whole year in the mountains instead of taking time to travel to and from St. Louis each spring and fall. A supply caravan would come west each spring laden with goods and return to St. Louis with beaver skins. Rendezvous was not just a time to swap goods. For Bridger, it was a connection to the life he had left behind some 1,200 miles to the east. It was also a time to learn what had happened to fellow trappers who had been hunting other regions and what had transpired with the leadership of the company during the past year. Pilot for the Brigades. Following the 1826 rendezvous, Bridger became one of the leaders in William Sublette's foray into the dangerous but beaver-rich lands of Blackfeet. Over the past 2 years, Bridger had proven his reliability and self-reliance through his solo exploration of Bear River to the Great Salt Lake, his solo shooting of the rapids at Bad Pass, and his leadership with Fitzpatrick in retrieving the stolen horses from the Bannocks. Though Bridger was only 22 years old, he had 4 years' experience and was now one of the spies sent several miles ahead to scout the terrain and report any danger or possibility of attack. He would then signal his discoveries or report directly to the brigade leader. The Sublette party trapped their way to Pierre's Hole in present-day eastern Idaho, which offered stunning views of the Teton Range and its three prominent peaks. This became one of Bridger's favorite places. These peaks had been called the Pinnacles, the Pilot Knobs, the Three Paps, and the Three Brothers. The Shoshones called them Hoary-Headed Fathers, but the romantic name that prevailed was the French Trois Tetons, meaning Three Breasts. The name had earlier been attached to a formation on the Snake River Plain that came to be called Three Buttes. The trappers crossed the mountains west to east, either through Conant Pass or Teton Pass, and came to the stunning valley on the eastern slope of the Tetons, soon to be known as Jackson's Hole, after David Jackson. But the beauty of the setting was countered by the cunning of the Blackfeet, who harried the American interlopers. From that high valley, the brigade trapped north along the course of the Lewis River, a tributary of the Snake River. The land kept rising, and soon they stood 600 feet above the river. The brigade eventually came across a huge alpine lake, refreshingly cool and remarkably blue. They called it Sublette's Lake. It would later be known as Yellowstone Lake. In the 1820s and 1830s, this band of adventurers, which included Bridger, became the most significant group of explorers ever assembled in North American history. They called themselves Mountaineers, and Washington Irving described them, "A totally different class has now sprung up, the Mountaineers, the traders and trappers that scale the vast mountain chains and move from place to place on horseback, heedless of hardship, daring of danger, prodigal of the present, and thoughtless of the future. There is perhaps no class of men on the face of the earth who lead a life of more continued exertion, peril, and excitement." Wintering on the Wind River. In the fall of 1828, Bridger piloted Robert Campbell's 12-man brigade to Crow County. They hunted along the Powder, Tongue, and Bighorn Rivers, and then wintered with the Crows on Wind River under Longhair, an 80-year-old chief whose hair measured just under 10 feet long. His people had to carry it for him as he walked. Bridger likely guided Campbell's brigade to Crow Country again in 1829. In January, Beckworth decided to leave the brigade and live with the Crows, but he embellished his departure with an implausible tale of Bridger reporting the painful news of his death and the trappers mourning his loss. The 1829 rendezvous was held on the Popo Agi near the Wind River, and Campbell traded for 4,076 pounds of beaver pelts that he hauled back to the States. A second rendezvous of sorts happened that year at Pierre's Hole, where the mountain men were finally reunited with Jediah Smith. He told them how the Mojaves had killed 10 of his men in the summer of 1827 as they tried to cross the Colorado River in two shifts, and how the Kilawatset Indians had killed 15 of his party on the Umpqua River along the Oregon coast in 1828. Bridger may have piloted Jediah Smith and William Sublette in fall 1829 as they traveled the Snake River, the Missouri River headwaters, and the Yellowstone River. On their way to winter camp in 1829, they crossed the mountains from the Yellowstone to the Bighorn, where the snow was so deep they had to break a path for their horses and mules. The animals still sank to their haunches in the snowdrifts. They lost 100 animals from starvation and from being trapped in the snow. The Mountaineer. It was obvious to Bridger and the rest of the men on Wind River that they could not find enough forage for their horses and would soon be counting their animals' ribs. To reach a valley where their horses could survive, they would have to cross the mountains. On New Year's Day, 1830, they began their journey, trudging through deep snow by day and huddling around fires by night. By mid-January, they reached Powder River, the paradise they had hoped for. Buffalo roamed thick in the cottonwoods and grazed into camp, a walking feast coming right up to the cook fires. They had to post double guards to keep the buffalo from trampling their lodges. Bridger and others regularly gathered cottonwood bark for their horses, carrying branches to camp, making draw knives to strip the bark, and bringing the shavings to the horses, which crowded each other to get to the nutritious peelings. They shattered the solitude of winter with the echo of axes, the braying of the mules, and the whoop of the mountaineers. They told epic tales of adventure and filled the night with stories, some of them true. Smoke floated in a haze above their fires as they tried to retell from memory the storylines of their favorite books. Joe Meek, a Virginian who had come to the mountains the previous summer, learned to read while sitting at the campfire. He labored over an old copy of Shakespeare, which, with a Bible, was carried about with the property of the camp. The ice broke in April, and the trappers set out to cross the mountains with Smith as their captain and Bridger as pilot. Bridger led them to the Tongue River and then the Bighorn. A heavy snowfall made travel difficult, and Bovey's Fork of the Bighorn River quickly rose from the runoff. They led their animals into the swift current, but it proved too strong for them and swept many away. The animals gasped for air and screamed in panic, and the mountaineers struggled to not be pulled away with them. 30 horses drowned, and 300 traps went down with them, a significant loss to the trapping brigade. Bridger led them west over a low range through Pryor's Gap to Clark's Fork, the Rosebud, and finally the Yellowstone River, which was still high in its banks. They made bull boats by stretching buffalo hides over willow frames and floated themselves and their gear across. Bridger then took them to the Musselshell and the Judith Rivers, where Henry's men had trapped their first season in the mountains in 1822. As always, the Blackfeet were a constant presence, harassing the trappers and stealing traps and horses. When they reached the Bighorn, a party of men under Samuel Tulloch tried to evacuate a cache of furs. The overhead soil caved in on Meek and a Frenchman named Claude Ponto, who often spent his money on riotous behavior. Their companions dug the trappers out of the caved-in cache, only to find Meek seriously injured and poor Claude Ponto dead. He was rolled in a blanket and pitched into the river. This was the same Ponto who 2 years earlier had returned to St. Louis from the 1828 rendezvous to find out his brother had died. He told his companions, "I am mighty glad my brother died and I got his fine clothes." Despite this deadly incident, Tulloch got his pelts and joined the other trappers as they headed for the 1830 rendezvous. Bridger looked forward to the gathering, but had no idea of the good fortune that lay in his future. Night of the Rockies. Bridger is often viewed as his era's greatest American frontier scout. His knowledge of the West was uncanny, and his frontier survival skills were unparalleled. He could read the land at a moment's glance and recall thousands of miles of past trails in an encyclopedic recital. His contributions to Western exploration and history are enormous, though the details are often forgotten today. He discovered Great Salt Lake when he was 20 and ran the Bad Pass Rapids at 21. He led Rocky Mountain fur trappers, including Kit Carson, throughout the West, and interpreted and mapped for the Great Horse Creek Treaty of 1851. He built Fort Bridger on the Oregon and California trails and helped chart Bridger Pass and the overland route that became the preferred route across the Rockies. Bridger guided more trappers, immigrants, miners, engineers, scientists, and soldiers than any scout in American history. He was the chief scout for noted cartographers and scientists Stansbury, Warren, Hayden, and Reynolds, and he guided major military expeditions for Johnston, Collins, Connor, and Carrington. Equally significant, Bridger was a friend and ally to the Shoshone, Crow, Flathead, Nez Perce, and Ute Indians. He was widely respected by the Cheyennes, Sioux, Arapaho, and other indigenous people, and could invariably treat with them to avoid conflict. He blazed the Bridger Trail and advocated for its use to try to prevent the bloody war with the Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho that lasted from 1865 to 1868. When the Army foolishly selected the Bozeman Trail instead, he tried to protect the lives of soldiers who built their forts in Indian lands. Bridger went west at age 18 and lived among the Indians in the mountains. He had a sense of family when he traveled with the fur brigades. Then he married and had his own family with the Flathead woman, Cora, the Ute woman, Chipeta, and the Shoshone woman, Mary. When he had to leave Fort Bridger, his only permanent home in the West, he settled in Westport, Missouri. But he also lived on the road as a scout for more than a dozen expeditions. When he wasn't guiding, he often found a bunk at Forts Laramie, Phil Kearney, and C.F. Smith. All of Bridger's life, he searched for home. In that journey, he found America and helped shape it. True West, December 2021 edition. City of Dreams by Michael Engelhard. The odds are good that a visitor to Nome, Alaska, landed as a cruise ship passenger or spectator of the Iditarod race finish, will pause before an antique roulette wheel enshrined at the Carrie M. McLean Memorial Museum. A label below the hairline cracked painted disc says it came from George Lewis Tex Rickard's Saloon, the Northern, once located just up the street. Luminaries from Wyatt Earp to Jack London, pulp fiction writer Rex Beach, and President Herbert Hoover supposedly touched this relic of frontier entrepreneurship. That has been hard to prove. A son of the couple who gave it to the museum remembers playing with it as a child in his parents' attic. How it got there from the Northern and how it got to the Northern remain mysteries. Rickard had befriended Jack London during the Klondike Gold Rush and opened the first Northern in Dawson. A gambler to the hilt, he lost his share in it. Conceivably, the roulette wheel then traveled with Rickard from Dawson to Nome. He convinced his pal Wyatt, who briefly managed a canteen in St. Michael at the Yukon River mouth, to help him in mining Nome's miners. The starry-eyed visitor imagines the town's rowdier glory days, for there's never a law of God or man runs north of 53. Jack London used Rudyard Kipling's lines as an epitaph to a tale set in the city where no tree could be found for a lynching. A boomtown is born. Nome, incorporated in 1901, became, during the summer of 1900, the territory's largest settlement and the world's busiest seaport without a harbor. About 15,000 gold hunters alighted in June, weary of the Klondike, Seattle, or San Francisco. More left Adelaide, Australia, on the steamer Inca 2 years later. droves of mariners jumped ship to join the fray. Nordman, woefully late for the Klondike in 1898, had unleashed all this wanton craving. The Swedish tailor, Erik Lindblom, leapfrogged north as a deckhand on a whaler. Jafet Lindberg from Norway wrangled free passage, pretending to be an expert herder. John Brinston, the third of these three lucky Swedes, had wrested wealth from the ground professionally, mining iron and coal. A limestone outcrop on a mountain above the creek where the trio struck pay dirt lent the settlement its initial name, Anvil City. Within a year, Anvil Creek's entire silver-gray schist bed got worked over at least once. A mapmaker's scribbled cape name, misread, then may have morphed into the headland and town's current designation. From the perspective of arrivals anchored in Norton Sound, the foreshore's low ridges appeared littered with icebergs. Up close, those dissolved into a warren of canvas tents. Camps sprawled across 30 miles of coastline from Camp Rodney to Camp Known. Men piggybacked women to shore, queens vastly outnumbered in the Anglo anthill. Mountains of freight clogged the beach, a black sand strip 60 feet wide. Grain, hay, general merchandise, mining equipment and provisions, sewing machines, luxuries heaped up there amid driftwood, pianos, fancy mirrors, and casks of brandy and bourbon, and eggs, selling for $15 a case. Longshoremen simply dumped freight next to the water's edge. A team of huskies hauled a wheeled water barrel, mutts powering Bacchus's chariot. Absent natural shelter or sanitation, mayhem reigned with tarps flapping and dog packs marauding between fly-buzzed offal and broken boxes. The city eventually commissioned waterfront closets on pilings the tides flushed. Greenhorns broiled in the sun, or shivering under blankets, hugged hostile ground. Some not eating regularly, improvised huts with packing crates or boats flipped onto their sides. A Newcastle-on-the-Tyne coal miner died of typhoid in his beach abode, leaving behind a watch, compass, rifle, and knife as his sole possessions. The chief of police pulled a letter from the miner's pocket. FEMA, a sweetheart in England, had begged her man not to go to Alaska, but to come home. Lumber had to be freighted in, as the driftwood was of poor quality. An embalmer and undertaker announced his hope to put up a morgue as soon as supplies arrived. The city of Chicago became a hotel and beer garden. The Quick Step reached via gangplank a restaurant and hotel. A forerunner of Wild Wild West steampunk, designed to ease into the shallows on barrel wheels to dredge the seafloor, was so heavy it never moved. An even grander harebrained scheme proposed building a casino, theater, saloon, hotel, and dance pavilions, a marine league from shore on ice to evade gambling laws. The town teemed with lawyers and laborers, hostlers and quacks, card sharks and clerks, madams, storekeepers, laundresses, land speculators, and dance hall girls. Nome sprawled all length and no breadth, 2 blocks wide and 5 miles long. Boardwalks covered Stanman Avenue only. Front Street, a dust bowl in the summer, here and there bottleneck to 15 feet. In the fall, a slough of despond, it swallowed wagons up to their axles and mules to their bellies. For one fortune seeker, it really was part of the beach. Mobs roiled, foghorns moaned, saws ripped, surf and hammers pounded. Mongrels fought over scraps, mules bawled in their traces. Nome was a perfect babble of noise. Arctic Babylon. The veteran prospector E.C. Trelawney Ansell thought cheaper, easy to access Nome, merely stepping out of a lighter after he had boarded a steamer on the west coast, lured more shifty-eyed schemers than had the arduous Klondike. Nome was different. It was a place where the creeks and the town itself filled with thousands of chichacos who had never known the hardship of the trail and few, if any, other hardships. Worse still, the camp and surrounding country was filled with gamblers, cutthroats, and murderers of the worst kind. Nearly all the promising claims had been jumped at least twice by July 1899, and multiple claimants contested others. The three Swedes were accused of being aliens, and thus having staked the best grounds illegally. Two actually were naturalized citizens. In November, a headless body washed ashore. A Cape York recorder suffered when his cabin and books burned. The fact that one miner had secured over 140 claims there could have been a clue. A Cripple River recorder refused to surrender his books, holing up in a house described as an arsenal. He swore the re-election ousting him had been rigged, that more ballots had been counted than persons present in the room, and that some lived outside the district or had not lived at Cripple 30 days. The more things change, the more they stay the same. In December, a man was killed on a sled, with his two partners, guns, and provisions missing mysteriously. Since they shared three prospect pits and a fine house, a tower made mainly of sod. Petty criminals prospered as well. Joseph Carroll, a Fleet mail carrier and expert trailsman, absconded with three dogs and the wrong sled. He had been in a bad frame of mind for a day or two, it was said. Thieves wheelbarrowed coal away and from a permafrost cache, snatched 20 sacks of flour and 17 dressed chickens saved for Thanksgiving and Christmas. Brazen burglars slashed tent sides, pumping in chloroform to rob marks the moment they fainted. The daughter of a Russian trader and Eskimo mother, Chagunak Antisarluk Ardriwuk, Senrock Mary, or the Reindeer Queen, at one point owned Alaska's biggest reindeer herd. The government, 6 years earlier, had launched a program to convert starving Inupiaqua seal and walrus hunters into capitalists, recruiting Laplanders as instructors. Rum runners and grifters connived to cheat Chagunak out of her wealth. Prospectors slandered the imposing curly-haired woman who adopted orphan survivors of epidemics. They threatened and sued her, harassed her deer, scattering them, and shot some they left rotting on the tundra. They offered liquor to cloud her judgment. Miners staked turf inside grazing ranges, torched vegetation to clear ground, destroying forage, and, having eaten or scared off all game, rustled the reindeer. Rex Beach, having encountered Gnome's misfits, fictionalized some in The Spoilers, which saw five screen adaptations. The wartime one starred Marlena Dietrich and John Wayne. Yellow Kid, operating a gold scale, smoothing his hair often, harvesting ounces of trading dust after each shift from his hand, brillionated with syrup, perhaps was invented. Beach's real-life foils included an embezzling postmaster, a tax assessor nabbed for shady financial deals, and a crooked federal judge. Protection monies changed hands where bar owners ruled the city council. Gold, driving all, in Thomas Hood's words, was heavy to get and light to hold. Stolen, borrowed, squandered, doled. And squander they did. Saloons mushroomed seemingly overnight, 42 by one count, over 60 by another, among them Earp's Dexter, Richard's Northern, Charles Cobb's Horseshoe, William Robertson's Eldorado, and one of Nome's finest, the Second Class Saloon. Dick Dawson owned it with partners, plus Brussels carpets, electric lights, Eastern beer only, the extravagance of a sewer and all. Dawson felt every saloon man but him bragged about running a first-class establishment, hence the tongue-in-cheek advertising of his. The Nome Gold Digger, one of four local papers, broadcast news about epic gaming sprees, noting that Keno caught on at the Hunter like an epidemic of the measles, or that an El Dorado craps session run haywire forced the dealer to upend his cash drawer on the table to prove the bank had really been busted. Glimmers of hope. The clink of a coin wasn't always so crass. The first baby born amidst it to an ex-whaler and a sister of Sinrock Mary in the Eskimo camp on the Snake River Spit was christened Gnome, and the proud father reserved a claim for him. A Fox Robe fundraising raffle, a free Thanksgiving meal at the Northern, a club supporting Scandinavians, miners' grassroots meetings, the odd congregational service, and literary society debates and recitals sounded social grace notes. The Flying Dutchman, Carl von Nobeldorf, en route to San Francisco, dropped off mail for miners still stuck in Dawson or Skagway. The previous fall, he had ice skated on dulled whipsaw blades hundreds of miles between Kobuk River camps, delivering newspapers and letters for $1 each. Rumors and gossip he carried for free. Dressed in knee-high checkered socks, wool cap, sweater, and mitts, a pack with a sleeping roll on his back, pistol and hunting knife on his belt, the bearded Germanic Hermes swung a metal-tipped pole for propulsion and balance. This newest migration, word of which Novelsdorf had helped spread, swamped the poor man's diggings, because on public beaches, no man or woman had to stake or register claims. No ground had to be thawed out either. Besides the rich ruby, garnet sand, the news crowed, there is coarse gold. It may be in large amounts. Latecomers marveled at damsels in flower pot bonnets and ankle-length skirts over petticoat layers, feeding rockers and slushers with shovels of muck. For many miles along the beach, double ranks of men were rocking, almost shoulder to shoulder, passing jokes or singing as they worked, a U.S. Department of Labor agent reported. Instead of streets paved with gold, five-year-old Klondie Nelson, joining her father, a Klondiker, on Ophir Creek, saw an ugly blanket of soft coal smoke hanging low over everything. Homesick miners there paid a herder to play Santa for Klondie and gave her nuggets as presents. True whoppers lay in them there hills. Until 1989, a slug from Anvil Creek's number 5 bench, weighing as much as a gallon of paint, held the title of largest lunker unearthed in Alaska. The district also coughed up the 6th, 7th, 9th, and 10th ranked ones. By century's turn, the Bering Strait fields already had yielded $3.5 million, and the next two decades netted another $80 million. The dark side of dreams. The glitter hid grimmer realities. Behind Gnome's false-fronted boxes lay dozens of prostitutes, cribs, fenced off in the stockade with their own phone system and messengers. Women billed as actresses or vaudeville entertainers worked at saloons where their popularity boosted lucrative sidelines. There were more of these in Gnome than in any mining camp I was ever in, Trelonsky Ansel recalled. Nothing in the worst days of Montmartre in Paris or on State Street Chicago ever paralleled the shows given here. Cigar stores, too, could serve as a front for ladies of the night. A few escaped this meat market. Charlie the Bear made off with Halibut Face Mary. A stinker named Misery Chris eloped with Toodles. And the King of Denmark stood up before the preacher with Deepwater Dora, wrote Frank Defrance, Klondie's future husband. As town got more civilized, the retiree's primrose past was forgotten or politely ignored, since, in almost every case, the old dance hall habituates became the strictest sort of wives. Japanese Mary was less fortunate. Ever the sporting woman, she bet $1,000 on a compatriot in the winter marathon held on an indoor track and invested her winnings successfully by grub-staking prospectors. She was found strangled with a towel and shoelace, a gold nugget necklace and a cross, and all her money gone from her hutch. The Demonade dames were tough, though. They drugged and rolled Johns or rigged scales weighing payments for services rendered. Daisy Straws, of evil repute, for reasons unknown, in the street, brained a man with a hammer, but a soldier broke up the fight. In extremis, morine or opium made life bearable, or ended it. Nome's grand jury recommended that to curb sin, women should be barred from saloons, and those without visible means of support be watched, and, if lacking decorum, prosecuted. Raiding the red light district, the law threatened prostitutes with arrest unless they paid a $10 fine that funded the fire department and police. Military patrols enforced compliance with public health regulations. A pest house for medical outcasts, quarantined for smallpox, had sprung up about a mile and a half away. The army also expelled people without lodging or means to procure it before winter's onset. The Call of the Wild. Wyatt Earp, homeless in a different sense, was 52 when he disembarked in Nome. Though his walrus mustache showed streaks of silver, he had not reformed into a proper senior citizen. The aging gunslinger traveled with his common-law wife, Josephine Sadie Sarah Marcus Earp, a gambler and former dancer and good time girl, still a beauty at 37. Her gambling habit ran rampant in Nome until Wyatt cut off her funds and asked fellow barmen to do the same. An octagonal bone chip, if authentic, suggests that he signed some of the Dexter's custom-made gambling chits, which he handed to desirable customers in lieu of his calling card while he roamed town looking for Sadie or on business. These could be redeemed for a drink. Other establishments used trade tokens for liquor or dances with girls. In a pinch, male partners sufficed. In 1897, the couple had heeded Gold's call. 2 years later, Earp and partner Charles Ellsworth Hoxie had built the Dexter, Nome's first two-story wooden showpiece. Among the town's largest, poshest saloons, it sported 12 club rooms upstairs. Under 12-foot-high ceilings, miners went broke, playing faro, monte, blackjack, or billiards. Across from the Dexter, Rickard at the Northern banked on a scientific mixologist bartending below nude paintings, but foremost on roulette and bare-knuckle prize fights. He would go on to become a Barnum-like Madison Square Garden boxing promoter, staging Jack Dempsey in the first boxing match to attract a million-dollar crowd. On slow days, Earp walked to the cratered beach, plinking whiskey bottles he threw in the air. After a drink or two too many, he once got the idea he was a bad man from Arizona and he was going to pull some rough stuff, according to B.D. Blakesley, a civil engineer mapping the region. Marshal Albert Lowe simply slapped the erstwhile terror of Cowhand's face and took his hog leg. He asked Earp to go home, to bed, or he would run him in. In 1901, the year before the Fairbanks gold strike, Earp and Sadie returned to California $80,000 richer. Locomobile's steam chase, a primitive car at the time, cost $600. The year after, they moved to Nevada, where another bonanza, more brawls, and yet another den of iniquity beckoned. By 1915, Earp had drifted into Hollywood, trailing Jack London, whom he knew up north, having wintered at Rampart on the Yukon River, when London left the Klondike luckless and wan, but brimming with stories. One day, both were dining with one-time cowboy, sailor, and movie actor-turned-director Raoul Walsh. Before long, the world's highest-paid entertainer and future star of the Gold Rush sauntered over. "You're the bloke from Arizona, aren't you?" Charlie Chaplin said to Tombstone's ex-deputy marshal with evident awe. Tame the baddies, huh? He looked at London and nodded. I know you too. You almost made me go to Alaska and dig for gold. Michael Engelhard lived briefly a block up the street from the Discovery, now a private residence, finding the town's liquor too expensive, the churches too many, and the wind too atrocious. True West, December 2021 edition. Elmer Kelton Country by Johnny D. Boggs. A trip tracking the Texas author across the Lone Star State is sure to create memorable stories. The frontier town of Mobidi was taking on some of the appearances of civilization, although not all the realities of it. That's the first description of a Texas town in any novel by Elmer Kelton, 1926 to 2009. The West Texas native had written short fiction for several magazines in the 1950s, but Hot Iron, published in 1956, was his first novel. That crowded and distinguished company of Western storytellers must make room for a newcomer, the Springfield, Missouri News and Leader wrote. This is that different Western you've been waiting for. The 30-year-old was just getting started telling those different kinds of Westerns. Buffalo Wagons, published a year later, won him his first Spur Award from Western Writers of America. Six Spurs followed, plus four Western Heritage Wrangler Awards, including one for the art of Howard Turnpin for Outstanding Art Book, the Owen Wister Award for Lifetime Contributions to Western Literature, induction into the Western Writers Hall of Fame, and praise as the greatest Western novelist of all time. None of his works fit exactly into the stereotypical Western genre, the New York Times observed in 1986. Kelton usually wrote under his own name, but used pseudonyms Alex Hawk, Tom Early, and Lee McElroy, and while some novels strayed outside of Texas, he set most in the Texas he knew best. Panhandle Tales. Mobidi, Mobidi Jail Museum, was established in 1874 as a buffalo hunter's camp, Hydetown, and grew with the establishment of Fort Elliott and the Jones and Plummer Trail for those buffalo hunters. In Hot Iron, Espy Norwood is sent to manage a panhandle ranch and brings his 11-year-old son into a range war. Kelton returned to the panhandle with Buffalo Wagons about the slaughter of buffalo herds by white hunters in the 1870s, and Kelton revisited Hide Hunters in The Spur-Winning Slaughter, 1992, which fictionalizes the 1874 attack on the Adobe Walls trading post northeast of Stennett in Hutchinson County. Though crude, Kelton wrote in Slaughter, the little village had a certain straight-line symmetry. It was not a place that would impress a man who had spent most of his life in and around the mannered villages of England. Give it 100 years and it might come up to civilized standards. Kelton created most of his towns, or rather transformed towns that he knew well, as a journalist for the San Angelo Standard Times and livestock periodicals, giving them names like Catclaw, Dry Fork, Piedras, and Rio Seco. You won't find Caprock in his 1920s oil boomtown depicted in Honor at Heartbreak, 1991, on any Texas map, but it existed in Crane, where Kelton was born. My father's family were ranch people, Kelton wrote, while my mother's were tied to the oil fields. The panhandle town of Borger, Hutchinson County Museum, or West Texas's Midland, Permian Basin Petroleum Museum, could have also passed for Caprock, our little Sodom in the Sandhills. Another Spur winner, The Day the Cowboys Quit, 1971, was based on an 1883 cowboy strike around Tascosa near Amarillo and home to Cal Farley's Boys Ranch for at-risk children ages 5 to 18. Talk about a different Western. Nobody got shot to death in the story, Kelton told the New York Times. There wasn't any big gunfight. One man died in the whole book, and he died offstage. Kelton enjoyed writing about the panhandle, from Amarillo, American Quarter Horse Hall of Fame, to Canyon, Panhandle Plains Historical Museum. Palo Duro Canyon State Park served as the inspiration for Kelton's The Far Canyon, 1994, a sequel to Slaughter. And Kelton was a top draw at the Cowboy Symposium in Lubbock, National Ranching Heritage Center. But he covered most of Texas. Expanding the Western. The 1970s saw an increased depth in Kelton's prose. The Black Cowboy's Fight Against Prejudice in Wagon Tongue, 1971. The 1950s drought in The Time It Never Rained, 1973. A fictionalized version of Gregorio Cortez legend in Manhunters, 1974. And the serio-comic story of a turn-of-the-century cowboy, The Good Old Boys, 1978, adapted as a made-for-TV movie for TNT in 1995. When he wrote about actual events, Kelton had a gift of making a point without exaggeration or gore. Massacre at Goliad, 1965, told of a young Texan's brush with death during the Texas Revolution, when Mexican soldiers shot to death prisoners at Goliad, Presidio Nuestra Señora de Loreto de la Bahia. Jimson gave voice to the sudden, horrible realization that swept us all over. My God, boys, they're gonna kill us. I heard someone cry out. Men began to pray. One man dropped to his knees, his head bowed. Someone shouted, "Rush them, boys, it's our only chance." On the Recollection by Frank Claymore, a thinly disguised Charles Goodnight of the massacre of Kickapoo Indians in 1865 at Dove Creek near present-day Mertzon in Stand Proud, 1984. He saw an older man, an overseer of sorts, waving a white cloth, shouting something that was lost in the rush and the wind. The man went down, his horse bolting away. The white cloth caught on a bush and continued to flutter its lost message in silence. At home in West Texas. Kelton specialized in West Texas, never an easy, benevolent land, he wrote in The Good Old Boys. For whatever it yielded up, it exacted a price. Most of his fiction was set around San Angelo, where he lived most of his life, and where he is buried at Lawn Haven Memorial Gardens. It's a handy town, a soldier says in The Wolf and the Buffalo, only to be corrected, it's more like a boil on a soldier's butt. The Buffalo soldiers from The Wolf and the Buffalo were stationed here, and visitors can learn their true stories at Fort Concho National Historic Landmark. It's not hard to imagine the good old boys, Huey Calloway, eating at Miss Hattie's restaurant and cat house lounge, or getting into trouble at Miss Hattie's Bordello Museum. Kelton's presence remains large in San Angelo, including Raul Ruiz's sculpture at the Central Library, Style Reed's downtown mural, and the Kelton books for sale at Cactus Bookshop. Kelton's funeral at San Angelo's First United Methodist Church concluded with the playing of Happy Trails. Very Western historian Paul Andrew Hutton told the New York Times, "All the way." Wide spot in the road, Fort Griffin State Historic Site. Since 1948, Fort Griffin State Historic Site has been the primary home to what the state legislature recognized as the official state of Texas longhorn herd in 1969. Official longhorns also graze at San Angelo, Copper Breaks, Abilene, and Palo Duro Canyon State Parks. Part of Elmer Kelton's 2002 novel, Ranger's Trail, was set around Fort Griffin, and the region the fort protected from 1867 to 81 was territory Kelton often covered in his prose. The parasite town that grew up around the military post was a mecca for buffalo hunters. Historical figures, including Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, Bat Masterson, John Selman, Kate Elder, and Lottie Dino reportedly hung out there. Ruins of the fort can be seen today, along with Settling the Plains, the story of Fort Griffin, an informative documentary at the Visitor's Center. More than 30 campsites are available, or lodging can be found in nearby Albany.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.